The headlines this hour. President Ebrahim Raisi says that Iran is determined to win the war of sanctions that the U.S. has waged on the country. The Yemeni army conducts a strike as a warning against the illegal shipment of Yemeni oil by the Saudi-led coalition. Plus, Russia says it has repelled Ukraine's attempt to break through its line of control in the southern Ukrainian region of Kherson. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. President Ebrahim Raisi says that Iran is determined to win the sanctions war imposed by the U.S. and other adversaries, citing a 13% growth in non-oil exports this Iranian fiscal year. Raisi says those who have enforced sanctions against Iran aim to prevent the country from achieving any growth, producing or exporting anything. He says the U.S. Treasury Department has created numerous obstacles for Iranian exporters around the globe, as enemies want Iran to be a mere consumer. But Raisi stressed that Iranian manufacturers and businessmen are determined to promote exports now that demand is rising for quality Iranian-made products, including military hardware. He says that this has angered Iran's enemies who don't want the country to grow and to capture markets. Iran has condemned what it calls contradictory comments by U.S. officials regarding negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear agreement. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says American authorities continue to exchange messages with Tehran, while at the same time fan the flames of anti-government riots in Iran. The top diplomat argues that U.S. officials are seeking to exert political pressure in an effort to win concessions during negotiations. The comments were an apparent response to statements by U.S. authorities who announced that the JCPOA revival negotiations are no longer on Washington's agenda. Amir Abdullahian rejects this and says it is a priority for the Americans to reach an agreement, and they want that as soon as possible. The foreign minister stressed that Tehran will move within the framework of an agreement in which its red lines are respected. However, he added that Tehran will not leave the negotiating table. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemns Israel's recent airstrikes against Syria. The Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem believes the attacks are in line with the regime's continued crimes against Palestinians. He stressed that Hamas is standing by Syria in the face of the Israeli aggression. Hazem Qassem said the resistance movement would continue to develop and strengthen relations with Syria. He added that Israel's increased aggression in the region aims to put pressure on active resistance groups and prevent them from supporting the Palestinian cause. The Hamas official argued that Tel Aviv's normalizing ties with some Arab states is meant to push the same agenda. Comments came hours after Israel launched a missile strike into the vicinity of Damascus. Syria says its air defenses have shut down most of the missiles. Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful under international law. That is according to a report by the UN Independent Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. The commission is now pushing for the issue to be referred to the International Court of Justice. However, it remains unclear whether the report will change Israel's behavior when it comes to violating Palestinian rights.
The Twitter account of UN Human Rights Council addressed the report published by the three-member commission and shared the link to it. The title of the report very clearly addresses the occupation to be unlawful under international law with zero ambiguity. The report states the reason for the conclusion to be the permanence of the occupation as well as Israel's de facto annexation policies. Navi Pillai, chair of the commission, stated, "Recent statements by the Secretary General and numerous member states have clearly indicated that any attempt at unilateral annexation of a state's territory by another is a violation of international law and is null and void. 143 member states, including Israel, last week voted in favor of a General Assembly resolution reaffirming this." The chair also further added, "Unless universally applied, including to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, this core principle of the United Nations Charter will become meaningless." The 28-page report published by Navanethem Pillai, Milun Kothari, and Christopher Sidoti highlights the sustenance and the advancement of the settlement enterprise. and the continuous expansion over the past couple of years that resulted in many Palestinian families to be forced out of their homes only for foreigners who've never been to the land to occupy their homes.
Yaakov, you know this is not your house.
Yes, but if I go, you don't go back. So what's the problem? What are you yelling at me? I didn't do this.
But it's easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
Yeah,
you are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going
to
steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yammi.
Statements by Israeli officials that showed their intention to maintain permanent control over the expanding settlements were also noted in the reports and were part of the reason why the occupation was declared unlawful. Chair of the commission also recognized the direct and indirect transferring of Israelis into the settlements as a plan to ensure permanent Israeli control in the West Bank.
Israel has a long record of violating human rights and international law. However, the UN has, in most cases, just expressed concern over those violations. Now, the newly released report by the UN Rights Commission seems to be a rare instance of the world body taking a firm stance against Israel. Yet it's a matter of time on how Israel would respond, as the regime has shown in the past that it has no respect for UN measures.
The Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including Al-Quds and in Israel. That is the name that the UN gave to the commission in May of 2021 when the UN Human Rights Council held a special session on the grave human rights situation in the Occupied Palestinian Territory. During the session, the UNHRC decided to establish an urgent international commission of inquiry to investigate alleged human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories at the hands of Israel. The recent report is the culmination of what the three-member council has found during the past year and a half in what seems to be an uncharacteristically direct accusation of Israeli human rights violation and breaking of international law. Let's take a quick look at some of the bullet points mentioned in the report. An allusion to the core principles of the UN on annexation, which Israel seems to have also agreed to, even though it has violated it. The existence of a settlement enterprise and the efforts to make settlement permanent, violating the rights of Palestinians who were forced to leave as settlers took their homes by force. Israelis' exploitation of land and natural resources, the restrictive urban planning and zoning policies that seize Palestinian construction as an impediment to settlements that result in frequent confiscation of land, demolition of homes, and eventually displacement. The silent harm and psychological trauma resulting from erosion of economic, social, and cultural rights of Palestinians in a coercive environment that fragments the Palestinian society. The necessity of international action as Israeli government's actions are seen by the Commission as criminal, particularly its direct and indirect transfer of civilian population into occupied and annexed territories. The report seems to be a step in the right direction for the UN to fulfill its sole responsibility of standing up for human rights violations globally. But whether or not the criminal accusations towards Israel will lead to an International Court of Justice investigation and trial remains to be seen, especially when Israel has the unwavering support of the U.S.
Yemen's army says it has carried out a drone attack on a southern oil port to warn the Saudi-led coalition against plundering the country's resources. The army spokesman says what he called the basic warning strike was aimed at preventing a tanker from looting Yemeni crude through an oil terminal in Hadramaut province. Yahya Sari says the vessel violated a ban on the transfer and export of Yemeni oil products. He also vowed more such strikes to prevent the plunder of the country's oil wealth. This is the first such incident since the UN brokered truce between Yemen's Ansar al-Resistance movement and the Saudi-led coalition came to an end earlier this month. The coalition launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015. The correspondent Yusuf Mowry says the Saudi-led coalition keeps plundering Yemen's oil wealth, despite an agreement signed to settle the issue.
Well, yeah, the peace agreement basically ended military activities on paper. However, you still have much of Yemen's natural resources being looted. by foreign nations under the government of the Saudi-backed government, right? So what you basically have here at play is a corrupt government being backed by Saudi Arabia that's basically selling Yemeni oil and gas to foreign companies, most of which reside in Europe, and they're basically selling the natural resources, gas and oil, below international market price, and they're basically, these corrupt officials are making money under the table. And the message being delivered here by the Sana'a government is, enough is enough, the game is over, no longer will Yemen allow its natural resources to be looted by foreign nations because of corrupt government officials being backed by Saudi Arabia and a Saudi-led coalition. And this is why the Sana'a government launched these two bomb-driven drones which targeted the terminal, in the port of Adaba, to basically send a message that if this Greek oil ship loads any oil or gas resources onto the ship, it's going to be targeted.
Russia says it has repelled an attack by the Ukrainian military to break through the border in the southern Kherson region, where it is evacuating civilians in anticipation of a counteroffensive.
The enemy attempt to breach the Russian troops' defenses by sending up to two battalion tactical groups on the west side of the Kherson region. All attacks were repulsed. The enemy was pushed back to their initial positions.
Konashenkov added that Ukraine's offensive aimed at a number of settlements on the west side of the Dnieper River. Russia has been under pressure in Kherson as it braces for a Ukrainian push to retake the region. Authorities in Kherson have called on residents to immediately leave the city. The commander of Russian forces in Ukraine has described the military situation in those areas as tense and difficult. He says Ukrainian forces are deliberately targeting the infrastructure and residential buildings in Kherson. Since late August, Ukraine has recaptured hundreds of kilometers in its counterattacks. Kyiv says that Russian strikes on energy facilities have caused massive blackouts across Ukraine. The Ukrainian presidency says more than 1 million households are left without electricity. More than 670,000 of them are in the western region of Khmelnytsky. According to Ukraine's energy minister, Russian air attacks have hit at least half of Ukraine's thermal generation capacity since October 10. As much as 40% of the country's energy infrastructure has been seriously damaged. The chief of Ukraine's national energy operator says some parts of the country are reducing their electricity use by up to 20%. Energy authorities believe the voluntary measures are not enough for the regions where the infrastructure has suffered the most damage. As the war in Ukraine continues to rage, our reporter Johnny Miller investigates allegations that the Ukrainian army is killing pro-Russian civilians in areas that it retakes.
A refugee camp somewhere in the Luhansk region of Donbass. The civilians here are Russian speakers who fled recent Ukrainian advances not far to the west.
Now, the people here won't speak to me. They are simply too scared. I've also been told not to give the exact location of this site or even the town that we're in fear that the Ukrainians might target the center with artillery strikes.
They also tell me that they are scared to be put on Telegram channels like this, called Collaborators of Luhansk. It posts the photos and details of anyone accused of working with the Russians. It includes teachers and nurses.
I didn't see it personally, but there were men fleeing from Krasny Liman on bicycles, as there was no petrol. They told me the Ukrainian army could do anything there, shoot people down, cut them if they didn't like what you said. And that's why I left my grandmother's. I told them I couldn't stay and that I was leaving.
We fled to the side we wanted. I lived in Ukraine. I'm not against Ukraine. I'm against its government. We are all scared. If Ukraine controls my town, I won't be able to return. We'll have to look for somewhere else, or go to Russia.
Along the battle lines, pro-Ukrainians generally flee west. Pro-Russians flee east. The ethnic boundaries of this once mixed country are being defined more clearly.
While this is a proxy war between Russia and NATO, it is also, at its root, a civil war between Ukrainian nationalists and its Russian-speaking minority, who are mainly situated in the east and the south of the country. The fact of the matter is, there is a strong likelihood, even a probability, that if Ukraine was to ever take back these four regions, there would be ethnic cleansing of the Russian-speaking population. The people here in Donbass say that this attempted ethnic cleansing by the Ukrainian army has been going on for the last 8 years.
While Russia and NATO continue to pursue their objectives on the battlefield, there is increasingly a peace to be made and new borders drawn if the views of the people living here were listened to. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
The former British Finance Minister Rishi Sunak has qualified to enter the race for Prime Minister as former Premier Boris Johnson begins to launch his political comeback. Johnson rushed back to the UK from holiday to join the race and to jockey up support from Conservative lawmakers in Parliament. Rishi Sunak has already gained the minimum support needed to formally contest the UK's top job. However, opposition politicians and even some in Johnson's own party say that they have lost confidence in Johnson. The former premier resigned in September following a Tory revolt over a slew of scandals and allegations of misconduct. He was replaced with Liz Truss, who stepped down on Thursday amid growing calls for her resignation over a host of issues, including her controversial economic package. A new survey has found that millions of households in Britain are skipping meals as they struggle with the country's deepening cost of living crisis. The findings show that inflation has returned to a 40-year high after food prices soar. The U.S. looks set to have greater influence over the EU as the bloc's leaders seek to become less dependent on imports from Russia and China. Washington is stepping in to replace Moscow as the EU's major energy supplier. But the associated costs are enormous.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Acts of violence and vandalism by Israeli settlers targeting Palestinian properties are routine in the West Bank throughout the year. Reports of acts of violence and vandalism against Palestinians are also rarely prosecuted by the Zionist regime forces. Olive trees are an indispensable source of revenue for many Palestinians, particularly in the West Bank, and acts of vandalism are a deliberate attempt to stifle their means of income. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. In this regard, Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The olive harvest season in Palestine has started. For Palestinians, the olive harvest is not just important for the local economy, but is a national event expressing unity, social cohesion, and defiance of the Israeli regime occupation. The Zionist regime often erases ancient olive groves in the occupied Palestinian territories to build illegal Jewish settlements, confiscate Palestinian land for whatever military purpose, or simply break the spirit of ordinary Palestinians. This is why the olive harvest is an important Palestinian occasion to send a message back to the Zionist regime that the relationship with their land is as strong as ever." Meanwhile, the website of the Electronic Intifada on the Zionist regime's settlers' attacks on Palestinian farmers wrote, "Feroz Youssef is taking all the precautions he can to fend off ever more aggressive settler attacks on his land west of Salfit in the occupied West Bank. The farmer 37 has already seen his land, 30,000 square meters outside the town of Azavia, divided into two by Israeli regime separation wall, where it dips deep into the West Bank, southwest of Nablus, in the Salfit Governorate. Never peaceful settlers from the nearby settlements of Ariel, Alei Zahav, Pudul, and Barkan have been acting even more aggressively over the past several months. Last year, according to the UN, Palestinians in the West Bank had to endure the highest recorded levels of settler violence in recent years. Fearing for his safety as well as his livelihood, Youssef has constructed a wooden hut on top of one of his bigger olive trees. The hut is about 5 meters squared and is built on the tree trunk, some 3 meters up. It is outfitted with plastic windows and boasts a sheet metal roof. A single solar panel provides electricity. Inside, there are chairs, covers, and bedding, enabling Youssef to stay overnight on his land. This serves two purposes. He can keep an eye on his land at night, and he is not subject to the capricious moods of Israeli troops at checkpoints to reach his land in the mornings. Youssef is by no means the only farmer to come up with this idea. He estimates that around 230 other local farmers have built huts on their lands for the same purpose. He fears, however, that the Israeli military might come and destroy the hut, as has happened to others. Settlers are wreaking havoc in small communities around the West Bank. Hardly a day goes by without some reports of cars being vandalized, civilians being assaulted, or trees being targeted. There are more than 280 settlements in the West Bank, outside of East Al-Quds. These are home to some 440,000 settlers, lured there by tax breaks and other financial incentives offered by the Zionist regime. Some 150 of these are so-called settlement outposts, attracting more extreme elements among the settlers. Some of these outposts are being legalized to become full settlements. A third of the outposts were established over the last decade. All pose a threat to the security of Palestinians in the vicinity, and the Zionist regime military is another source of danger for farmers and others. At least 26 children have been killed by troops or settlers this year alone. Most settler attacks take place in Area C. Some 60% of the occupied West Bank, which is under direct Israeli regime military and administrative control. Youssef Farm is in Area C, where the Zionist regime apartheid system is quite brazen. Israeli settlers are treated as civilians under Israeli law, while Palestinians like Yusuf in the same area are subject to military rule. There is little to no protection for Palestinians in Area C or anywhere else. The military does not have the authority to intervene against settlers since they are seen as civilians. It is a fine distinction that B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights group, calls meaningless. Settler violence, the group holds, is a form of government policy, and troops almost never have to face any consequences for their actions. According to another Israeli rights group, Yesh Din, in the years 2019 and 2020, the Zionist regime military received a total of 273 complaints related to violations committed by troops against Palestinian civilians. Of these complaints, just 56 investigations were opened, or about a fifth of all complaints submitted. Yesh Din attributed the small number of opened investigations, a number that is decreasing year on year, to a deliberate policy to raise the threshold for opening criminal investigations. Ultimately, the group found only 2% of complaints resulted in prosecution. Ahmad Al-Mahmoud, 66, from Kafar al-Dik, further west from Salfit, suffers constant vandalism by settlers from the nearby Al-Izahaf settlement, to which he has already lost 6,000 square meters of his 13,000 square meters of land, now surrounded by a metal fence and off-limits to him. Murad Shetvi, head of the Colonization and Wall Resistance Commission of the Northern West Bank and a coordinator for unarmed resistance marches, told the Electronic Intifada that settlements have led to the confiscation of thousands of dönems of agricultural land in the Salfit Governorate. The entire area of the governorate is about 26,000 dönems, Shetvi said, with 11,000 located in Area A and under the Palestinian Authority, and 15,000 dönems are in Area C. A dönem is equivalent of 1,000 square meters. Salfit Governorate contains 25 Israeli settlements, Shetvi added, the largest of which is Ariel, which is built on land belonging to the villages of the area, including Kafar al-Dik and al-Zawiya. The most dangerous settlement project in Salfit is the occupation's attempt to expand the Ariel settlement by establishing an industrial zone there and linking it to a settlement that is being planned in the Ras area and Khalat Hassan area west of Salfit. Ahmad al-Mahmoud also built a hut on his land. In fact, it was built several times because the Israeli regime military kept demolishing it. The latest demolition was in September 2020. He rebuilt it less than 2 months later. Today, the hut is multifunctional, including as a recreational place for his family and grandchildren. Settler attacks increase more during the harvest seasons, al-Mahmoud told the Electronic Intifada, adding, especially the olive harvest. Settler gangs prepare themselves for the September-November harvest by cutting down olive trees and stealing their fruits. And it is not just Palestinians who are targets. Settlers have been known to target foreign and Israeli activists when these have turned up to protect farmers for the harvest, pelting them with stones or assaulting them with clubs. Al-Mahmoud does not only have to contend with direct assaults, he told the Electronic Intifada. When the Zionist regime in administrative control over the area, he has yet to receive permission to dig a water well for irrigation purposes. He still has to rely on trucks carrying water tanks to irrigate his trees once a week.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
As was announced, the topic that inshallah I will be covering will be the cultivation of an Islamic identity in a postmodern era. I say that because sometimes I think our job in the West is to convert the entire street we live on. No, it's not. The tolerance of which Islam preaches is incredible. And that's where I think a lot of my youth don't understand this idea of identity. Identity is not simply to reject everything around you. Not everything in the West is to be thrown out or cursed. There's a lot of beauty in this part of the world that can really help Islam grow. So we have to apply the exact same principles here. There are principles where we live, doesn't matter where you live, in the East or the West, that either we reject, or we redirect, or we use. It's all part of identity building. A few examples. Number one was his migration to Medina. There were existing Jewish tribes there. The Prophet never came in and said, you are to convert to Islam or lose your life. Absolutely not. The beautiful system of the jizya in Islam is a beautiful discussion. One day, someday, we'll have it. The tolerance by which this system now presents itself to other faiths is a lesson for you and I. Please, I ask my youth out there, and so many of you right now are in front of me, and when I pull in to the driveway, I see these guys in the back with their yellow jackets. My salams to you. It's incredible to see this young blood now serving this community. Incredible. But I also know this, that when it comes to Islam, there is some trauma. I have some young guys telling me, when they find their voice, and they find their himmat, and they find their boldness, they tell me, look, I'll be very honest, Sayyid, when it comes to Islam, anything to do with Islam, namaz, fasting, the masjid, mosque, muharram, whatever you name it, I have this pit in my stomach. I have anxiety. You talk about the grave and death, forget it, I'm out. I'll leave the actual hall. You talk about hijab, I'll put my fingers in my ears. True story. Until you're done talking about hijab. Where is that coming from? And yeah, they'll tell me. I had, let's say, for example, a horrible experience growing up when it comes to religion. I had a horrible dinyat Sunday school teacher who just got mad at me because I couldn't figure out which namazes were wajib and which were not. I asked a scholar one day years ago a question and I got him on a bad day. He was a cranky scholar. And he snapped at me. I thought, oh, forget it. I'll never ask a scholar another question again. I enter those doors. I get some auntie now judging me, some uncle judging me, asking me 1,000 questions, fixing my hijab, telling me my beard is too long, my jeans are too tight. Forget it. All these things are there. I'm always told, for example, that the hellfire and the squeezing of the grave and the punishment, right? I've been told since I'm a child of a God of fear, a God of fear, a God of fear. God was the boogeyman inside of my house. God was the bad cop inside of my house. If you don't do this, God will do this to you. That's my picture of Islam. Now at 23, you want me to submit to this? I'm sorry. All legitimate, by the way. Some people might think, oh, boo-hoo, you're coddling today's youth. I'm not. I think those are legitimate discussions. But my question to you is, you're not 9 years old anymore. This is not grade four dinyat. You're 23 years old. If you want to erase all that, you can. How? Seek out the religion. A statement I mentioned at Al-Mahdi about a couple hours ago, seekers will seek. And the deen is a deen to be sought after. And the amount of things that are there for all of you now to capture and grab and rebuild your deen is incredible. Never happened when I was your age in this city. My father would tell me that, you know, we had so many questions about the deen, there was no avenue to ask. If I asked one or two questions to an alim, they would summon my father. It's kutamisa kawya. How dare he ask me a question? Baba, he is curious. No. Now, anywhere, everywhere. Picking out food at Costco, I get stopped. True story. I love it, by the way. I was looking at some cantaloupe, and I had a tap on my shoulder, and they asked me, are you Asa Jaffer? Yes, I am. This is what I love. I have a small question. I said, okay. Halka sawal, as they say, halka. It's all, and these are discussions about, like, you know, free will and predestination and things that require an ashra of majalis. I'm like, look, let's pick out the cantaloupe and we'll discuss as we go towards the cashews and the almonds, inshallah. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So it's important that we understand that if you are now somebody in this hall right now, online, out in the in the women's hall, that has this trauma, I get it. I'm not downplaying that at all. But fix it now. Some ulama out there right now are doing incredible work with incredible organizations, putting together packages of durus and animations and podcasts. I mean, incredible work that I benefit from. Now there's no reason that you can't remove that pit out of your stomach. So the first example is the example of arriving in Medina. He doesn't say to the Jewish tribes, convert. No, he doesn't. To me, the most beautiful lesson, one of them at least, is the way that the Prophet welcomed the Christians of Najran. To the point where even some ashab were saying, are you sure, Ya Rasulullah? They came, they said, look, we don't have a place to stay here in Medina, and we need a place to worship our God. And the Prophet gave them his mosque to worship. Come in, you can stay here at the mosque, you can worship. And they worshiped in their own way. And there was no one there. The companions would come and say, Ya Rasulullah, these are Christians in our mosque. No problem. You talk about things like, for example, the example of Imam Khomeini, who was in France, exiled to France. They say that, you know, 1 year it was the Eid of Adha, Eid al-Qurban, and his companions now, or, you know, those who are with him now, had said to him, Agha, let's sacrifice an animal in the backyard here where you're staying. It was against the law in France to do that without some sort of permit or some permission. And right away, Imam Khomeini says, no, it's against the law here in France. I'm trying to build a few, you know. So bear with me in these next few nights. It's important that we lay out this foundation so I can build on that foundation. Imam Khomeini says no. There is a whole respect of the law of the land that the fiqh has. If that wasn't enough, we talk about the idea that the Prophet not only gave his mosque for worship, but he gave them to stay there as well. One thing that I think gets lost in the event of Mubahila, and I'll move on from Mubahila, is that the aftermath of Mubahila, that treaty that they signed was an incredible treaty. A beautiful, that simply isn't discussed enough. That was broken later on, post-Prophet of Allah, by the second Khalifa. It was broken by him. But the Prophet had said, look, these are people who will live, they'll pay the tax, and we are in charge of their security. Nobody is to hurt them. No one is to attack them. They can worship as they wish. My point is, Islam was never about an all or nothing mentality. Islam never said to arrive in a certain location and convert the entire world. I think sometimes we have that same notion when it comes to Imam Zamana, that he's going to come and convert everyone to Shia. Pura Jahan Joy Shia. No, that's not how it's going to work. I'm sorry. The very role of Nabi Isa is to go and work with the Christians to revive the asl teachings of the deen. My point is, an Islamic identity is a tolerant identity, an accepting identity, one that works with other faiths.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Kareem Azim Alim Halim حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
The United States is the only large wealthy country in the world that doesn't have universal health care. The US health care system ranks last among high-income countries. After the news about the recent drop in US life expectancy, a new survey has found that 56% of the US public believe health care in general is handled not too well, or not at all well. Now we have taken a look at the world's media on this issue. Please stay with us. A new survey data released recently has shown that about 12% of the American public think healthcare in the United States is handled extremely or very well. Further evidence of the deep unpopularity of a profit-driven healthcare system that has left roughly 30 million Americans without insurance coverage and contributed to the country's stunning decline in life expectancy. The new Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll finds that 56% of the American public believe healthcare in general is handled not too well or not at all well, while only 32% believe healthcare is handled somewhat well. In all, just 1 in 10 Americans, or 10%, feel the US healthcare system as a whole and healthcare for older adults are handled well or extremely well. The opinion poll reveals that public satisfaction with the U.S. healthcare system is remarkably low, with fewer than half of the American public saying it is generally handled well, according to an Associated Press report. The opinion poll shows an overwhelming majority of the American public, nearly 8 in 10, or 80%, say they're at least moderately concerned about getting access to quality healthcare in the United States when they need it. Survey results will come as no surprise to those who have attempted to navigate the Byzantine U.S. healthcare system to obtain basic care, which often comes at such prohibitively high costs that millions of people each year are forced to skip medical treatment to avoid financial ruin as insurance giants and pharmaceutical companies rake off huge profits. The Associated Press NORC findings, based on interviews with 1,505 individuals, U.S. adults, between 28th of July and 1st of August 2022, shows that just 6% of the American public feel prescription drug costs are handled well or extremely well in the U.S., where pharmaceutical firms have broad authority to set prices as they please. As for potential solutions to the country's long-standing healthcare crisis, the new opinion poll shows that about two-thirds of American adults think it is the federal government's responsibility to make sure that all Americans have healthcare insurance coverage, with adults aged between 18 and 49 more likely than those aged over 50 to hold that view. The percentage of people who believe healthcare coverage is a government responsibility has risen in recent years, ticking up from 57% in 2019 and 62% in 2017, according to the Associated Press. More specifically, the opinion survey shows 40% of the American public support a single-payer healthcare system that would require Americans to get their health insurance from a government plan. Depending on how the question is framed and phrased, single-payer, more commonly called Medicare for All, has polled as high as 70% support. According to the Associated Press NORC survey, 58% of the American public say they favor a government healthcare insurance plan that anyone can purchase, a public option. Recent research shows that a Medicare for All system of the kind proposed in new legislation introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Pramila Jayapal, a Democrat from Washington, could have prevented hundreds of thousands of COVID-19 deaths in the United States over the past 2 years. In the richest country in the world, no one should die or go into debt just because they don't have access to health care. Representative Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, tweeted last week. She added, "We need Medicare for All right now." According to Forbes, some 80% of the American public worry about how they will access good health care, according to a new Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research opinion poll, which found the vast majority of the American public are dissatisfied with the system in the United States, one of the only developed nations that doesn't offer universal health care insurance. People of color were more likely than white people to be concerned about accessing good health care in America, with 60% of the black and Hispanic adults concerned about access to health care, compared to 44% of the white population. Some two-thirds of Americans believe it is up to the federal government to ensure people have health care, up from roughly 57% in 2019, according to the survey. but only 40% of the American public say they want a single-payer healthcare system that would mandate Americans get health insurance from the government. More, or 58%, would prefer a government healthcare plan that would be available for anyone to buy, according to the opinion poll. Americans gave an even worse review of how the U.S. handles prescription drug costs, mental health care, and nursing homes. Only 6% of the American public, or even fewer, said they were very satisfied with those services, according to the new opinion poll. 31.6 million Americans, that's how many people didn't have health care insurance in 2020. During the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, or nearly 10% of all Americans, according to a survey from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. The United States ranks the lowest among the wealthiest nations for its healthcare system, primarily due to a lack of affordability, despite spending the largest percentage of its gross domestic product, or GDP, about 19% of its GDP in 2020, on healthcare services, according to reports. It is one of the only wealthy nations lacking universal healthcare coverage, with the average American spending about $12,500 per person on healthcare costs in 2020.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. If God wishes to grant forgiveness to someone, this means healing the wound he inflicted on his own soul through sinning. So these true believers are those whose spiritual wounds God will heal, forgiveness and a noble provision. They shall have a provision without any abasement or humiliation, without any difficulty or grief. This is the kind of provision God will grant them. Whenever a faithful society comes into being, I am not talking about an individual, so do not say, "Thank God we have a morsel of bread to eat, so we are okay. We have no grief." Because when you really examine such a person's behavior, you see it is all misfortune and mistreatment of others. They do degrading work and they don't even see that what they do is degrading, or that this morsel of bread they have is a morsel of humiliation. I'm talking about a society. When a society's morsel of bread is clean, when it is noble, when it is earned with dignity, this is when its provision is noble and distinguished. And this happens when a society is truly faithful and displays the qualities I am describing. If this was the case, all of the slogans that political parties in the world today are loudly proclaiming from every quarter to every people, whether truly or falsely, in order to win votes, all of these slogans and promises could be achieved in a truly faithful society. Peace, freedom, prosperity, and ease, achieved without war, without bloodshed, through fraternity, through friendship, a high level of culture, a high level of prosperity, and a high level of living, all of these slogans and mottos, some of which are meaningful, others of which are meaningless, all of them would be actually achieved in a faithful society and a noble provision.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. Indeed, in the creation of the heavens and the earth and the alternation of night and day, there are signs for those who possess intellect. Those who remember Allah standing, sitting, and lying on their sides, and reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth, and say, "Our Lord, you have not created this in vain. Immaculate are you. Save us from the punishment of the fire." Surah Ali Imran, Surah number 3, verses 190 and 191. Today we will look at a few more verses on the topic of faith. There are a few points we must consider. Firstly, faith is one of the foremost qualities of God's prophets and the true believers who follow them. They have faith in their own message. This is the difference between divine leaders and the political leaders of today's world.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.